is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, March 29th, 2024. And today will be better than yesterday. Taylor Schwenk is producing this from back in Connecticut in his home, and I'm Buster Olney, and I'm down in Texas, back in my hotel room after the first broadcast that we've done, our Sunday night group. We had the Rangers, we had the Chicago Cubs. It was a phenomenal game, Taylor, and I could tell, like, by your face, how it was a fun first day of baseball.
It really was. I mean, just about every game had something interesting to chew on, you know, and I feel like you could just say, oh, it's opening day. But I feel like a lot of the sort of the storylines we'd been talking through in the offseason, they've kind of bore some fruit here. At least in day one, it was exciting. There was a lot of drama. My Orioles got it done. Corbin Burns absolutely shoving it. It was sweet, man. So a good day of baseball and then an excellent game on ESPN.
Yeah, it was a great game. A close game goes into extra innings between the Rangers and the Cubs. But bad news for the Cubs, Justin Steele, their ace, looks like he's going to be out a while. All right, some news and notes before we get to some of the highlights for the first day. Since the last podcast taping, the Diamondbacks signed Jordan Montgomery to a one-year deal for $25 million. It has a vesting option on a second year. It's pretty incredible that this is where we landed. Think about these numbers, okay? Jordan Montgomery and Blake Snell, two clients of Scott Boras, wind up signing for guaranteed dollars of about $87 million or so. That is about $50 million less. These are two left-handers coming off career years, about $50 million less than what Tyler Glasnow got with the Los Angeles Dodgers. Absolutely shocking. When I first heard about this, I got a text from someone with the Rangers saying that is a stunning deal that they got him on that contract. So not good for Jordan Montgomery coming off that really impressive 2023. The Dodgers signed catcher Will Smith to a 10-year, $140 million extension, right in the same neighborhood as Buster Posey's extension more than a decade ago with the San Francisco Giants. David Rubenstein was unanimously approved as the Orioles owner. And there was a lot of celebrating going on in Baltimore, a city that really needs that now, given what happened with the bridge the other day. You know, boy, a good day for the Baltimore Orioles, as you mentioned, Taylor. Some of the opening highlights, as I mentioned, we had the Rangers and Cubs in our first broadcast. It was 2-1 Cubs, bottom of the sixth inning. Adolis Garcia came to the plate.
Next offering, hit in the air, left field, and that one is way out of here. Gone. Adolis Garcia, solo homer. And we're starting over tied at two for Garcia, his first of the year.
All right, and that, of course, was the voice of the legend, Boog Sciambi, on ESPN Radio. Yeah, Justin Steele went down with an injury. He was making a play on a ground ball, and he immediately grabbed at his hamstring. What the Cubs announced during the game was that he has tightness in his left hamstring. It did not look good. It looked like one of those injuries where he's going to be out a while. This is their ace who pitched so well before he had that injury. Now, in the top of the ninth inning, it was 2-2 when this happened.
Swing and a miss, and that one squirts away from Heim and racing up to third. Now Bush is racing home, coming in, and he dives in safely. Racing for third is Nico Hoerner. Heim is arguing with Chad Fairchild. I think he's saying it was a foul ball.
It looks like on the replay he did.
It looks like it was a foul tip.
But even then, you got to play the play out. And Bush saw that Heim was so occupied, he took the plate.
Yeah, it did. It was a foul tip, and it should have been called such, but it wasn't Chad Fairchild, and he indicated to Heim right away, no, it was not a foul tip. Heim was arguing the play. He didn't chase the ball, and the Cubs take the lead in the top of the ninth inning. In the bottom of the ninth inning, World Series hero Travis Jankowski pinch hit for the Rangers.
3-2 now. Here comes. Swing and a high fly ball, pretty well hit. Right field, way back, and we are tied. Jankowski, a pinch hit homer, and it is 3-3 here in Arlington. Wow.
In the bottom of the 10th inning, this happened.
Heim waits the pitch. Swing and a line drive ripped towards right center. Base hit. And in to score is Josh Jung, and the Rangers walk it off in 10. And Jonah Heim, the hero. The Rangers victorious, and wouldn't you know it, the guy at the wrong end of what was a bad call in Jonah Heim ends up delivering. And the defending World Series champs win on opening night. 4-3, the final in 10 as they beat the Cubs.
In Baltimore, Taylor mentioned Corbin Burnes made his debut for the Orioles. When Mike Trout took his first swing, he homered to give the Angels a 1-0 lead. But classic Angels, after that, it was all the Orioles, all Corbin Burnes. Here he was in the sixth inning.
7-1 Baltimore. Some fans appreciating this. Here's the pitch. Curveball, strike three. Another strikeout for Burnes. He has punched out 11 on opening day. And he walks off the mound to a thunderous applause.
Yeah, the Orioles win 11-3 in that game. The Yankees face the Astros. Juan Soto got a big hit at the top of the fifth inning.
Lined into right field, it is a base hit. One run scores. Soto's first hit as a Yankee. Drives in a run. The Yankees are on the board. It's 4-1 Astros.
Michael Kay on the YES Network. The Yankees led 5-4, bottom of the ninth inning, and a ball was hit to Soto. Give a listen to this.
There's a base hit to right field. Dubon rounds third. They're waving him home. Here's a throw from Soto. Here's the play. He's out. They got him. They got him. A great tag by Trevino, and Soto got rid of it quickly for the second out.
And the Yankees would close it out 5-4. Blue Jays against the Rays. We talked about how Vladimir Guerrero Jr. looked great in spring training this year. It looked like he was in much better condition, and this is what happened in the top of the sixth.
Here's the 2-1 from Eflin. And it's hammered to center field. Siri in a jog. He'll watch it sail over the wall. A moonshot for Guerrero. 3-1 Blue Jays.
And on their way to an 8-2 victory, that from Sportsnet 590, The Fan. The Dodgers played the Cardinals, and Mookie Betts got a big hit in the bottom of the third.
First of the order, Mookie Betts swings at the first pitch from Michaelis and drives the ball deep to left and gone. Into the bullpen goes Mookie Betts, his second home run of the season. A solo home run makes it 3-0 Dodgers.
The Dodgers are on the way to a 7-1 victory. My God, they're going to score so many runs this year. The Padres and Giants, Jake Cronenworth starred over in Korea in the second game when the Padres beat the Dodgers. And he got a big hit in the bottom of the seventh today.
Here's the 3-1. Cronenworth swings, lines it into right field and a base hit. Merrill comes in to score. Bogaerts is being waved. He's going to score. Ball ends up at the base of the wall. Cronenworth ends up at second base. A two-run double and a 6-3 lead here in the seventh.
Yeah, so the Padres beat the Giants 6-4. And the Pirates face the Marlins. O'Neill Cruz had a great spring training, and he did this in the top of the eighth.
1-0 to O'Neill Cruz. Swing, fly ball, left field. Gordon back, and there it goes. Home run, he tied the game. He mishit the ball and sent it over the wall in left field for a game-tying home run in the eighth.
That is a strong man right there, Joe. Wow.
Yeah, so O'Neill Cruz had a great spring training, and he follows it up with that. The Tigers beat the White Sox 1-0. Twins beat the Royals 4-1 with help from Carlos Correa.
And the 1-2. Swung on and lined towards third. That is a fair ball down into the left field corner. Margo will round from second. He will score. That's Lewis hurt. Is hobbling into third base. Royce Lewis is hurt. It's an RBI double for Carlos Correa. Correa makes it a 2-1 game.
And some injury news. Matt McClain, the Red second baseman, who was so good at the end of last year, he had shoulder surgery. He is out indefinitely. Taylor, what else you got?
Buster, I got a... ask our listeners here. So it was kind of a funky week with the pod when we recorded and whatnot, and we had that Wednesday episode on television. We put the whole version of that show, the non-cut version, as a podcast as we normally would. So if you haven't listened to Wednesday's show, still applies. Bold predictions. We had Jeff Passan, Hembo, Kevin Pillar, Boog Shambi, Sarah Langs. Oh my gosh, who am I forgetting in all this? Jake Peavy, of course. Jake Peavy,
let's go.
Oh my gosh, I got a question for Jake Peavy. I got to ask him about Billie Eilish the next time we have him on. That's a tease for the future there. But
I don't know what that tease is about.
She wore his jersey on Saturday Night Live recently, and he doesn't. Yeah, he doesn't. At least at the time, he didn't know why. I want to know if he's gotten any more clarity on that. But Jake Peavy, awesome guy. I want to be his best friend. So check that out. And the new episode of The Low Post with Doris Burke, they're going to go through all their preseason predictions and just, embarrass themselves and show how wrong they were in good fun.
Oh, I know how that goes.
Oh, yeah.
How many times did it bring up the fact I picked the Padres last year?
I love that you wear that like a badge of honor, Buster. I love your honesty with it.
For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats, experience it live.
All right, we are in the clown car after the first game of the season, the Texas Rangers beating the Chicago Cubs. And guys, this is a perfect opportunity for first impressions. And we'll start with you, Carl. Of course, we have Carl Ravitch, we have Eduardo Perez, we have David Cohn. Carl, give us some opening thoughts here.
All right, opening thoughts. Wyatt Langford does not have a heartbeat. He's a rookie. He delivered a sac fly, got his first hit, came up in a huge spot in the extra innings, and put together a good at-bat, which led to Jonah Heim, who had made a mistake on what he thought was a foul ball, which allowed that go-ahead run to score. And it seems like in only the world of baseball does Heim get a chance in extra innings to redeem himself after, in a clown car edition, Travis Jankowski, who doesn't homer, hit a homer in a pinch hit roll. These were two brilliant managers, Bruce Bochy and Craig Counsell, going head to head, and their fingerprints were all over this game. Fabulous game, great start. I'm all in on it. Those are some of my observations. There's a million more, but I'll let Eduardo share his thoughts from one red nose clown to another.
Buster, I'm really concerned with the Chicago Cubs and their starting pitching now that Steele is hurt. His hamstring came out of the game after being masterful at the beginning, being able to manipulate that strike zone really well and getting quick outs from the Texas Rangers. But the bullpen's going to have to be used a lot, and Craig Counsell has to use his magic here in Chicago early on in the season, and let's see how long Steele will be out. But Imanaga, the pressure will be on him. It'll be on Kyle Hendricks as well, and the rest of the crew that does not have a lot of big league experience. So that's something that concerns me moving forward with the Chicago Cubs and the Texas Rangers as advertised. Adolis Garcia, not only did he have the shoes rocking, but oh my, the power still there. He hasn't missed a beat, as Carl called it in the game. Coney, it's all yours, buddy.
There we go. My impressions on both organizations, the Texas Rangers, in my mind, have great personnel. They have a great blend of some veteran players and some youngsters in the outfield that are going to contend for Rookie of the Year. I think their front office is fantastic. Chris Young is excellent at his job. He's proved it. Bruce Bochy, we know he's a Hall of Famer. When he gets done playing, it's going to go right into the Hall of Fame. So when you look at the Rangers right now with a couple of rookie outfielders, as I said, that are very dynamic, fast, athletic, and you look at their pitching staff with what's coming down the road, with Max Scherzer going to be ready maybe in May, and then Jacob deGrom going to be ready in August, that to me just is the reinforcements at the right time They score runs. They get these rookies playing well this year. Their veterans are right there. That they're going to be able to make a run. They're contenders again, I believe, to make a run at it. The Cubs, I think, are in a different spot. They're sort of, when you make a managerial change like they did and bring in Council, it's an infrastructure move. It's going to take a while for them to kind of rebuild things with the Cubs. They need some more help. Their pitching's a little thin, especially with the injury to Steele. The Cubs are an interesting organization to follow and watch, but they're a little short right now. The Rangers, on the other hand, I think are definite contenders. I don't know if I would pick them to go back-to-back, but I think they will make the playoffs again and take a run at it.
So he talked about Wyatt Langford and his low heart rate. You know, he intentionally walked in his first game in the big leagues, and Sarah Langs will have more specifics, but it's the first time that a Ranger rookie was intentionally walked in his major league debut in almost 60 years. I mean, think about that and the respect that they showed him tonight. Again, this is a great day for first impressions because there are so many teams in action. So, Carl, you can, you know, talk about maybe it's the Blue Jays and Vladimir Guerrero Jr., maybe it's something with the Tigers, some other team, something else that jumped out at you today.
Well, I think what jumped out at me today, we were watching because it was on the big screen here, of course, in Texas, the Astros-Yankees game, seeing Juan Soto's throw to cut down a runner at home, and the celebration between he and Judge, which ultimately led them to victory. That was I think the early games, especially games one, the first couple of games during your schedule, like we talk about spring training being a bonding experience or a trip to Korea. Those first games, when they go your way, it just feels like it's such a momentum swinger. It just sets everything right. You got to believe that, as you mentioned, Detroit after Scooble pitched such a good game. Vlad hitting 450. Like, that just feels so good. And to see Soto and Judge celebrate and have both he and Verdugo in left field make a big play, like, that's a big deal, I think. And it feels a lot more like two or three or four wins than it does just one win. You both have been there, Eduardo, Coney, Eddie. Does a win like the Rangers, when it's just one, feel a little bit bigger than just one?
I believe it does. It doesn't matter how early or how late in the season. Guys gravitate towards that, and you get put in a pressure situation, and especially when you have, you know, mistakes that were made by the Rangers, the Heim situation. You look at Evan Carter running the bases, and they were able to bounce back from that. And you see big wins in Houston by the Yankees, and you see the game that Tarik Skubal pitched today in Detroit, where it's a team that a lot of people pick as maybe a sleeper team because of their young pitching that is now healthy in a winnable division. So wins like this early on give that confidence boost.
For me, it's interesting that the Blue Jays, had a really good first day offensively because there was so much concern about their offense coming off of last year. And they essentially, well, after having a run at Shohei Ohtani, they wound up with the same cast of characters. Then they were betting on guys simply playing better. Vladimir Guerrero Jr., well, he hits a home run. George Springer, who really did not have a good year last year, he hits a home run on opening day. So it felt like an extension of some of the good things that were going on in spring training for them.
Just to touch a little bit on all those, yes, to Carl's point, when you have a new player like Juan Soto, chemistry matters. Early residuals matter. Relationships like he and Judge are developing really matter. To see that really is meaningful. But for me, the one standout story, just because I've been kind of AL East centric for better part of my life, is Baltimore. The Baltimore Orioles story is the story. The new ownership in place. One of their owners was buying a whole bar of beers today and setting up the crowd. They've got the number one prospect waiting in AAA to come up. They have the resources to make more trades and get more pitching, even though they got Corbin Burns already, and he came out big today. So to me, the story is Baltimore. They have funding for renovations of Camden Yards. They're going to be there for the next 30 years. They have a new owner with deep pockets. Baltimore's a problem right now. They're a problem.
So speaking of the Orioles, it was interesting. Matt Holliday came out And he noted that there was a business decision by the Orioles, that's how he framed it, in sending Jackson Holliday to the minor leagues. Give a listen.
You keep talking about the business aspect of this, which to me sounds like you're referencing service time manipulation. Is that a fair read on my part? Should we be expecting Jackson to appear in the next few weeks?
I don't know when he'll appear, but I mean, look, you call it what you want. I mean, you can call it what you want, but you know, I think if he was under contract, like the kid from Milwaukee, or you know, if there was no absolutely no free agency or no money involved, and it was just you took somebody and put them into a room, and they didn't know much about anybody, and they just watched baseball and they just watched spring training and asked you asked them who the best players at each position would be, I think there's a great chance he'd be on the team. But we don't live in that world.
Okay, Carl. What was your reaction when you heard that Jackson Holliday was being sent to the minors?
Reaction to Jackson Holliday being sent to the minors? Boo! 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 The game needs Jackson Holliday. The game needs its best players, and it's the one sport where that doesn't happen. And I understand it. But I don't like it, and I wish it would. I wish it would change. I know there've been some moves made to encourage teams to keep their top picks up and have them there the whole season, and subsequently benefit from that. People have compared it to others in the past. That I guess the only caveat to the Orioles is that the players that they have are really, really good players. It's not as if you're leaving Holliday off. And you're looking around and you think to yourself, well, he's so much better than the guys they have. He's very likely better, but it's the difference is marginal, especially given his rookie status. However, I mean, he did what Wyatt Langford basically did in the spring. He certainly did what he needed to do to make himself part of that team. And that part stinks for him. It stinks for the fans. But to Coney's point, you know, right now, everything feels good with regards to the Orioles. When you do have owners getting up on tops of bars saying we're buying a beer for everybody, and then they go out and roll. It was a continuation of what they did last year, and that was important for them. I don't think it's going to be long before we celebrate the Holliday in the major leagues, but it does stink that he's not there, and they'll only get better when he does show up. So, boo! Coney, you booing with me or what?
Yeah, no, I agree.
Coney's booing.
Is he 20 years old?
Yeah. Coney, yeah. He ready.
Yeah, I think we're all excited to see, you know, his talent, even though he's 20 years old. And, you know, it's sort of like, you know, you can justify maybe, a little more time, you know, just because they have...
Start the clock.
They have such personnel. But, yes, we do. We all agree on seeing the best players on the field right now.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear Bruce Bochy before the game. He talked about how... there was no question in him, and I know exactly. There was no question in his mind that Wyatt Langford was going to not only make the team at some point this year, but he was going to start the year in the big leagues. And it's too bad that that becomes an issue. And I'll always believe that part of the reason why that great group of Cubs position players didn't become a dynasty was because of the fact that I think the players at some point, they were not happy about how it became a business. And the best example of that was Chris Bryant having his service time manipulated, being left out in the minor leagues at the start of, the 2014 season or 15 season. I think that stuck with the players and really set a tone. I think it's a very different culture around the Rangers, where I think the players are confident that, you know what, the best players get to be in the big leagues. And just another thought about the Rangers as well, I remember watching this team in our first broadcast last year and kind of coming away from that thinking, boy, they have a lot of really good players here. And I didn't think they were going to win the World Series. That thought never really crossed my mind, but I thought they would be a lot better. Now, guys, as we walk away from here today after watching, you know, this team the last few days, I'm thinking, you know, very good about the pick that I made of the Rangers winning the American League this year. Because that is a deep team, especially with the offense, Eduardo.
Yeah, it really is, and it's a team that has a lot of confidence. Look, they're going to get their rings this weekend, and they know that they belong. They know they belong in this division. You look at last year, they just lost the division in the last week in Seattle. They had to travel to Baltimore. They played great on the road. They did not lose a game in the postseason on the road. A lot of confidence and a lot of structure. And, you know, you have to give a lot of credit to Bruce Bochy. He's let these guys play. He's let them have the personality. And it's led by Seager and Simeon up the middle. And because those two guys have been the way that they go out there, Seager is the way he works to prepare. Simeon, he posts every day. They're at the top of the order. They lead by example, and it just seems like it's contagious. We saw it tonight with the way that they were aggressive in the zone. Nobody was holding back, and it was fun to see consistent baseball in a game by the Rangers.
All right, that's it for this edition of the Clown Car podcast. The next one, perhaps, we haven't talked about it yet, perhaps will be after that game that we have on Sunday night, Cardinals and Dodgers.
This is The Numbers Game with Sarah Langs.
Sarah Langs, reporter producer for MLB.com. Sarah, I don't even have to ask you how you're doing. It's near the end of opening day. Games are still going on, and your smile is absolutely ear to ear.
I mean, it's been a great day. So many fun games. Our game on ESPN was so exciting. Great redemption story with Joan Hines. All of that. So yeah, just watching these last few games and getting ready for tomorrow.
All right, on the Clown Car edition, Eduardo Perez and Carl Ravitch and David Cohn all shared a first impression from opening day. Doesn't have to be about the Rangers, doesn't have to be about the Cubs, but something that really stuck out at you from opening day and from one of these games.
I mean, I'll talk about them in a minute, but Taylor's Orioles looked really, really good. There were a handful of teams that I thought were expected to be good and lived up to that, at least for day one. That was the first game, so they got kind of like an hour-long spotlight before everything else. And man, Adley Rutschman reaching base, each of his first 8 career plate appearances on opening day last year and this year, Gunnar Henderson on base all over the place, Cedric Mullins with a home run. They looked really, really good.
All right, let's play the numbers game. Taylor, you're back in action.
Let me make sure I don't mess this up. Number three.
Number three is 11 for Taylor's Orioles and for Corbin Burnes, who made his Orioles debut with 11 strikeouts, no walks, and one hit allowed. He allowed a home run to Mike Trout, and that was in. That was tied with Mike Mussina in 1998. For the second most strikeouts on opening day in Orioles or Browns history in the entire franchise. Only Dave McNally had more with 13 in 1970 and the 11 in his team debut, his first game with the Orioles tied 1932. Bump Heedley, who I will say I never heard of before this afternoon. Were the most in a team debut in Orioles or Browns history, that of course being it for the Browns.
Number two.
Number two is 14. So we only had 3 games going on after our ESPN game, but they have provided some interesting fodder so far. The Diamondbacks scored 14 runs in the 3rd inning against the Rockies. And we don't even need an opening day qualifier here. That's tied for the 4th most runs in an inning since 1900. At any point this season, only 3 teams have had more. The Red Sox in 1953 with 17. Rangers in 1996 with 16 in an inning. And the 1952 Brooklyn Dodgers with 15. But if we do care about the qualifier, it is the most in an opening day inning in that span.
Number one.
Number one is one for Wyatt Langford's debut. So we're talking about this. You and I were texting about this earlier this evening. In a key spot in the game, he ended up getting intentionally walked by Hector Neris. It was a very exciting moment. I think we all want him to come through, and I think the Cubs and Craig Council were afraid that he might come through in that situation. They give him the free pass. So he was the first player with an intentional walk in his major league debut since a player in 2020 named Daniel Johnson, but he was the second in Rangers or Senators history. The only other guy to do this was Jim French in 1965. It's really cool to see from a guy who I think we all expect will see a lot of intentional walks over the course of his career based on how we think it's going to go.
Yeah, boy, I mean, respect. And we had a meeting with Craig Council before the game, and I asked him, I said, what are your impressions of Langford, assuming that he had seen him in spring training at some point? And he mentioned that they faced him twice. And he said, you just do not see 22-year-olds that big and that strong. And you could tell by the way they handled him, they have a ton of respect for him, you know, for sure. So that was really that really caught your attention. So on a scale of 1 to 10, speaking of the Cubs, how big is this Justin Steele injury in your mind? If in fact it turns out to be a 6 to 8 week injury, what do you think?
I mean, if this is a serious injury, this is a huge blow. I mean, he wasn't expected to be the ace of that staff. And as you guys were all saying on the broadcast, this is not the deepest or most experienced pitching staff we've ever seen. They have Shota Imanaga, who of course they have high hopes for. You never want to put that kind of pressure on a pitcher who is a rookie in the majors, hasn't even pitched in the majors yet. So I will hope for the best, but the moment I saw that happen, first of all, you just feel awful for the player.
Yeah.
Especially because he made the play. It was a great play. And he was in the midst of saying, oh my gosh, what a play. And then you see him grab his leg like that. But certainly for the Cubs, I mean, you and I talked during the offseason a few times about expecting them to be, you know, pretty aggressive with the free agent market. And I'm not sure Bianco and Bellinger, we fully saw that. And this is where, of course, hindsight is 2020. We look back at that and maybe they would have wanted to have at least one other veteran starter in there as well.
I guarantee you, Sarah, after considering that Jordan Montgomery got a one-year guaranteed contract, with 2020 hindsight, we're going to be saying, what about Jordan Montgomery about 10 teams, it feels like, in the first 2 weeks after we see a bunch of injuries, that's for sure. All right, Sarah, thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me, Buster.
Tim Kuhn covers all sports for ESPN. He writes features for ESPN, and Tim, thanks for joining us. I loved your piece that on Shohei Ohtani that's now on ESPN.com. And I know it was a great piece, not because of, you know, my opinion, but my daughter, who really doesn't like sports, but she has been taking Japanese for 10 years and she's fascinated by the Ohtani story. She texted me and said, that was an incredible story. I love that story. She was asking me all these questions about you. So you impressed my daughter, who's in grad school in Japan.
Well, thank her for me. That's nice.
All right. So tell me what your impressions were of Ohtani. I guess give us the oral version, the oral history of what you worked on Ohtani.
Well, you know, I started, Buster, in the beginning of spring training. I went down with no knowledge that this story was what the story would end up becoming. And I've done, it feels like I've done a story every year on Ohtani. I started before he, in 18, before he played a game in the big leagues. I, you know, went to Japan. I talked to the people from his background. So, you know, I've been around the scene of Ohtani since he got here. And this felt different, right? I mean, we had a different storyline. He's a Dodger. He's finally, it almost feels like he paid his dues with the Angels and proved that he could do the things that nobody was sure he could do. I guess I was struck a lot by how little has changed and how much prior to the Ipe investigation and you know, Ohtani gambling scandal, which I would never have guessed. You know, that was so far off the radar. You know, you felt like he got to this point. He got this contract that maybe the Dodgers would expect more of him from a public relations standpoint, or from a, you know, just opening up a little bit to show people who he is. And you know, it was just as closed as ever. You know, Ipe was at his locker. Ipe was by his side constantly. And, you know, that has always struck me as something that I don't think serves him that well, him being Ohtani. But, you know, when this broke, when everything changed, it became clear just how alone he is in this game. Because, you know, nobody knows you, even your teammates don't have a real grasp of who you are, then, you know, anything seems possible, right? Like, nobody knows what nobody can say with any definite, you know, certainty that this is what happened, or he wouldn't do this, or this guy did that, because it's just there's this big hole at the center of everyone's knowledge about who Shohei Ohtani is when he's not throwing a ball or swinging a bat.
So, and you know this because you've been around Ohtani in the Angels clubhouse. I think by the time Ohtani left there, while they greatly appreciated Ohtani as a player, and definitely wanted to re-sign him, and were disappointed when he chose the Angels, there was also a sense of, okay, you know what? Life without Ohtani might also be good.
Exactly. And, you know, I spent a day in Tempe during spring training, because you're trying to always find out, you know, every angle of this. And in talking to his former teammates, my first question was, do you feel it might be easier to build a team and a team culture without that? And, you know, they without, again, like, as you say, Buster, they are very grateful for him. They appreciate him. They're in awe of him. But there was a feeling that, you know, we're going to be okay. We're going to be okay without all that commotion in the clubhouse of you know, 30 and 40 reporters every single day and having to answer for him. You know, I mean, that's the thing that players, they get, that wears on you after a while when somebody, the central character won't speak and everybody comes to you for your insights on a teammate. And I think they were okay with it for a while, but I think it wore on them. And you know, the Angels clubhouse with, you know, Ron Washington in charge, it seemed like a really happy place. That's for sure.
Yeah. And I got to say, just having been around the team, I didn't feel that, you know, at times, and I'm not someone who's a beat writer, is around the team every day, but I definitely felt at times like there was some Ohtani exhaustion, you know, in that clubhouse and in that organization. What are the Dodgers like, you know, with Ohtani this year? What was your sense of sort of their clubhouse dynamic, their organizational dynamic with Ohtani?
Well, I think the player dynamic, I'll start with that, is that you've got four MVPs in that room. You've got, I can't count the number of all-star appearances on that team. And, you know, I think that they're less likely to be, you know, stand at their locker and talk glowingly about a teammate. I mean, that's just the truth of it is that, you know, Mookie Betts is
he's got his own thing going.
He's every bit as good. You know, I mean, he's not, I don't know if he's every bit as good as Ohtani, but he's in the conversation. You know, it was funny at the beginning of spring training when Dave Roberts sort of designated, maybe tongue in cheek, Jason Hayward to be like this spokesman for Ohtani. Like, maybe Jason will be the guy that answers all those questions. I did not see Jason at his locker one time in eight trips to spring training when the media was allowed in. So that's kind of the vibe I get from there. The vibe I got from the organization was that there's a little bit of they're a little bit starstruck. I mean, that's the way it felt, is that they are going to let's put the pre-scandal and post-scandal together. Pre-scandal, it felt like they were willing to just go along with what the Angels did, you know, which is that he's on his own program. He's got Ipe as coach, you know, training partner, interpreter as the small end of his job description. And I'm curious if that changes now. I don't expect it will, no, because it feels like a circling of the wagons right now. But that's the vibe I got, is that they are, you know, so happy that he's there that it's, you know, I mean, he's not only a big investment, but he is a massive moneymaker. I mean, you walk around spring training and see the number of jerseys already. I mean, this guy, he might end up paying for himself, you know? I mean, he is a one-man economy. I got the feeling that there's still going to be this protective layer around Shohei, with or without Ipe.
We've got about 4 minutes left. You know, to your point about him being a moneymaker, you know, at the time that his deal was signed, I'm sure you got some of this feedback. Other agents thought that the contract, first off, the idea that, you know, we parrot $700 million, they laugh at that. They're like, the Dodgers are getting $68 million a year that they can invest in while they're making tons of Ohtani money. Do we think the Guggenheim Group is going to be able to, this investment firm could withstand do more money that, with yeah. it? I mean, they are, you're right. They're making so much money with it, to the point that I get asked in the aftermath of the investigation now, boy, the Dodgers must be devastated. I said, no, they're kind of in a no-lose situation to me, where, you know, and we saw it at the press conference the other day, where club executives walk in, they support him. And if something happened, if in fact, you know, there's something happens with Ohtani, they're in a position they can wave their hands and say, we didn't know.
Exactly.
Which is right. And so, and then they'll just, the money train will just continue no matter what happens. And so I think that it makes sense for them to support him as they go through this. In terms of the investigation going on, the way I've answered questions about whether do you believe him, what happened, that I just, to me, it's a series of questions that remain that are unanswered, yes, that the Major League Baseball needs to answer. For you, what are some of those questions as we move forward?
A very basic question that I had after listening and watching Shohei on Monday. How did all of this take place without him knowing? I mean, Ohtani, what I tell people is I would go up to Ipe, and if I asked him how many pitches Ohtani threw in a bullpen session, he would not be able to answer that. Oh, that's like, don't ask me that. Somehow we're now supposed to believe that for 90 minutes, he spoke to an ESPN investigative reporter, Tisha Thompson, without any knowledge from Shohei, that he did all this and Shohei didn't know what he was saying or how he was going to say, and that he learned in this team meeting that's when he learned that Ipe was a problem gambler. Okay, that's question number one.
Let me jump in real quick on that.
Sure.
That's part of my big question, is how is it that Ohtani's team and the Dodgers and Major League Baseball knew days in advance about this situation than Ohtani? That makes no sense to me. Go ahead.
None, especially when you know how that operation works, right? That there's nothing that it's, you know, nobody really goes out on their own in that Ohtani operation.
Right.
Secondly, just the wire transfers, the fact that it came from his account, the amounts, the massive amounts of being sent out. I've talked to people who are in that world who handle money for athletes and other high profile, high income people. And they say that would take three signatures in their office for something like that to be approved. Like that, those who's handling his money. The other question I have, and this is something that our investigative group, spearheaded by Tisha, has been asking repeatedly, is why haven't you revealed what entity you have?
Yes.
Who, this is criminal, right? This is, the man got, if the story is that the man was stole $4.5 million minimum, that should be reported to some entity. That should be like the, in the community where it happened or whatever. And nobody's saying who they have reported it to, or they just say, we reported it.
And well, why wouldn't
that's
they?
That's not enough. That's
and
not
why wouldn't they tell everybody?
Why wouldn't they? I mean, what happened through all this, the mishandling of a lot of these the situation where one story got out and then, you know, he had to backtrack. The one thing that they achieved, regardless of the truth in this, is that they made that first headline, Ohtani victim of massive theft. That was the win for the crisis PR, because that set the bar, right? That set the storyline, is Ohtani is the victim. And everything that flows after that has to either confirm or contradict that. Whether they thought it all through about the questions that would be asked and the way that people would delve into it is another question entirely, because there are so every time something is released or comes out, it's like it adds to the list of questions that I have. When I think the idea was to put it to rest on Monday, that in my mind, that's not what happened.
No, absolutely. All right. I think I might have to ask for a signed jersey or bat from you based on my daughter's fandom of your story the other day you're writing. Great story. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you, Buster. I appreciate it.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Jorge Castillo is ESPN's new baseball reporter. He's going to be centered in the New York area. He spent some time in spring training around the Mets and the Yankees. I want to make sure I got this right. Jorge, you spent 2 or 3 days around the Mets, about 7-8 days around the Yankees.
That's correct.
Okay. So with that in mind, you know, when I changed beats several times in my time as a beat reporter, I covered the Padres and then bounced to the Orioles and went to the Mets and went to the Yankees. I always thought that the most dangerous competition were guys, women who were coming in to cover a team for the first time, because you come in with a fresh set of eyes. So I want to tap into that. You're seeing these players for the first time. And so I want to get first impressions from you from some of the people you're covering, okay, and some of the storylines. First off, Juan Soto joins the Yankees. What's your sense of where Juan Soto is as he heads into a year in which he might make $450, $500 million in free agent and might actually create the real number for the highest contract in baseball if he passes Ohtani's number?
Yeah, the funny thing about me and Juan Soto is I was around for Juan Soto when he first came up, because I was in D.C. at the Washington Post covering the Nationals. I was there for his debut. I was there for his first series at Yankee Stadium. I was lucky enough to cover the World Series when obviously here in Houston and in D.C. And to me, from the beginning, from the jump, that guy was just another level of talent. The discipline to play, EPI combined with the power, it's just next level from the beginning. And I think with this, you know, coming to the Yankees, obviously it's like a 1 year trial run, basically, but hitting in front of Aaron Judge, I'm super fascinated to see how that's going to play out. Whether he will get more pitches to hit, what he will do with more pitches to hit, because he's such a selective hitter. Obviously that short porch in right field, I wonder what he's going to do with that. If his power numbers are going to go up. And between him and Judge, it's the 1-2 punch is like next level. I mean, you could argue, I know out in LA, they got their 1-2-3 in Atlanta. People are like, hey, what do you got? No one's talking about our guys. But between Judge and Soto, you got to wonder, is it 80 home runs, 90 home runs, 100 home runs between those two guys, and two guys that can carry an offense to the playoff. And it's a Soto is just a next level player. He's just, I don't know. It was kind of weird in San Diego there when he was there, but he was still producing. He's a super mature guy, young man. And I think he's going to handle New York and handle the pressure and handle his platform here super well.
So, you know, every incoming superstar in New York gets booed at some point. You know, when he plays his first game with the Yankees in Yankee Stadium, if he goes 0-for-4 with two strikeouts, he's going to get booed. That's just the way Alex Rodriguez, Jason Giambi, all those guys know that. And, you know, Juan will have those. But I do feel like that he's going to grow from his experience having been traded to San Diego. This is not the first time he's going to a new place. And I wanted to ask you, because you've known him since, you know, since he was a young player. That's when I first met him as well. All the stories swirling around the Discord in the San Diego clubhouse last year, I get asked the question, you know, do you think Soto is a bad guy? Do you think he's a bad clubhouse guy? And I'm like, no, I don't. I think he's a really smart guy. I think he's really focused on his work. And I think that, you know, the clash of personalities in the clubhouse, I mean, there's a range of people involved in that. But I'm telling people, I said, look, I think he's one of the smartest players that I've met. And I think he will adapt and grow as a person as he gets older. But you know him better than I do.
Yeah, you know, and I don't like using language as the barometer for intelligence, but the fact that he learned English so quickly.
2 years.
In 2 years. Is super. Like, by the time he debuted, he was doing interviews in English. And as someone, you know, with my background, my parents and came over and stuff, and I appreciate that. It's really hard to do. So, you know, and just his eye and his level, he understands baseball economics. He has that down pat. He understands the numbers. He understands everything. And so the clubhouse thing, I think he's just really kind of like a guy who's like on his own, doing his thing. He's not like some kind of like boisterous sort of cancer in a clubhouse. He's just, you know, a guy who has his routine and all that. And he's in his corner. It reminds me a little bit maybe of Corey Seager-ish, you know, just not necessarily like, you know, being, you know, loud and annoying or whatever. He just, you know, he's just doing his own thing. And I think, like you said, there were a lot of personalities in that clubhouse last year. They kind of threw together a bunch of stars and it didn't go well. So I'm interested to see how he fits. It seems like he's fitting in here in the Yankee clubhouse great already. And one other aspect of the New York thing is he's Dominican. And I think that's going to matter to a lot of fans there in New York City. You know, the biggest Dominican star in New York since Robinson Cano. So I think that's going to matter as well. And I think he's a beat off that.
Aaron Judge, your first impressions being around him. I have come to believe that he's one of the best leaders in the sport. You know, we know he's a great player, but my perception of him is that he's an excellent leader, someone who will put those big arms around Alex Verdugo, around Juan Soto, and those guys will benefit from that. What are your first impressions?
Super, like, cool, calm person. I mean, this is my first time around him on a daily basis. Available all the time, almost, you know, whenever you need him, which I think in our sort of world is when you get a superstar, it's not necessarily always the case. He does seem like a good leader. Guys really seem to, you know, gravitate toward him. And just as, you know, it's my first time around him, but it's just a baseball player. I don't know. It feels like he's like overlooked. I mean, this guy just hit 62 home runs 2 years ago. He did a bunch of, 37 and, you know, 100 some odd games after, you know, with that injury. He's still in his prime. And just being around him, I think he's poised for, he can stay healthy for a huge year. I mean, we just talked about it right now with Soto and him. I think those two guys can carry an offense. And just being around him, I caught the last year of Derek Jeter actually on the beat in 2014. And he reminds me a little bit of that. You know, he's always around, always available. He's the clear leader. He's the guy. And he's a great guy to have as the guy. And the Yankees knew what they were doing and giving him that contract. And it's just, it goes beyond just the offensive production. It's what he does off the field as sort of the Yankees, you know, the captain, the guy, the face of the franchise. And I think he does a great job with that.
Gerrit Cole, obviously a really important figure going forward this year. The Yankees' handling of the injury information to me was really telling. That it felt like they deferred to Gerrit throughout the entire process. No one's speaking out of turns. Everyone's going in line. And yes, they would love to have him back in 2 months, but I don't think anybody really knows as they go forward. What's your sense?
Same thing. You know, anytime you hear elbow, it doesn't matter if it's nerve, you know, UCL situation, whatever it may be, elbow's scary. And hearing that at this point in the season, knowing that Gerrit Cole is like the foundational piece in that rotation, obviously they need regardless if Gerrit Cole were healthy, if he comes back in June, whenever he comes back, the Yankees need a Nestor Cortez and Carlos Rodon and Marcus Stroman to have really good years to reach, you know, their goal regardless. Now it's just like, without Gerrit Cole, can you reach that goal? You know, even if these guys have good years and bounce back years, and he's arguably the best pitcher in the world. And anytime you hear elbow, like I said, it's scary. And that's literally probably one of the, I don't know if it's the worst thing that could happen to the Yankees in spring training, but it's close. You know, hearing that Garrett Cole is not going to be around and not making the start here on Thursday against his former team, which would have been an unbelievable matchup to watch. But you know, the hope is, like you said, maybe he does come back during the summer. We don't really know. But the Yankees' fate really kind of lies on his elbow.
What are your impressions about how much the Mets are trying to win this year?
Well, they signed J.D. Martinez, and you know, I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that his price dropped so much, and he's like making $4.5 million this year, and a bunch of it's deferred, and you know, that will help this year. But you know, during the offseason, it seemed like they were kind of just waiting it out. They tried to get Yamamoto, and that didn't happen. You know, they made smaller moves. Sean Manaea is a good move. Maybe Luis Severino pops off. Like, but this is not like that much better of a team. Or you can argue it's not better. You know, they're not better than this year. They had Max Scherzer and Verlander around. So I think the sense of, you know, in the industry and talking to people is they're waiting for next offseason. You hear the Juan Soto rumors already about that. You hear, you know, that free agent like class is going to be loaded. And Steve Cohen has money. So, you know, one of the questions off that is, you know, what happens to Pete Alonso if the Mets are – you know, out of the race? Do they say, hey, let's flip this guy, let's get some prospects, let's turn our attention to next year? If they're in it, do they add at the trade deadline? I'm super interested to see how that goes. Pete Alonso is another Scott Boras client. He will not be signing an extension at any point here. So that, to me, it's super interesting. I obviously the Mets are going to try to win, but you know, David Stearns is a guy that we've seen his formula in Milwaukee. He's not necessarily going to overpay for people, for guys or guys that he thinks, you know, like a first baseman like Pete Alonso. So they're going to try to win until, you know, maybe the trade deadline when they realize, you know, they're not going to win like they did last year.
So we had our friend Paul Hemikides on the show, and his bold prediction was that Pete Alonso is going to be traded this year. And I'm just going to play it a scenario. Let's say that they are, you know, below 500 or right at 500, and not really in the race, but not really out of it. David Stearns, you say, you look at his history with Milwaukee. He traded Josh Hader, his closer, when they were in first place. He non-tendered a guy, Chris Carter, who led his league in home runs. It feels like he follows the numbers. What's your guess if they're, you know, a little under 500 about what's going to happen with Alonso?
That's interesting. The Josh Hader thing, they were in first place, then they weren't. And, you know, you got to wonder, you know, trading Josh Hader, not only on the field hurt that team, but off the field in the clubhouse, how much that impacted the team. There were guys who came out and said, why are we doing this? Yeah. And I wonder, in New York City, you can't do that in New York City. I mean, this is different. This is not Milwaukee. You know, the fans.
You have to be, in your mind, you have to be clearly out of the race in order to trade.
You have to be clear. I think you have to be clearly out of the race. Unless this guy's like, you know what? I do not care. And I don't care if it's New York, Milwaukee, the moon. I'm going to do it anyway. And but I think New York is a different animal, and he can't necessarily, quote unquote, get away with something like that when the expectations are to win in New York City. And I know it's not the Yankees, but, you know, the Mets expect to win. They have the highest payroll in baseball. You know, the expectations, it's funny we're talking about, do they want to win this year? They have the highest payroll in baseball. You should try to win.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, Jorge, thanks for doing this. Welcome aboard.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for a Friday. You can call the Bleacher Tweet voicemail box whenever you'd like. The number is 406-404-8460. It's in the show notes. Don't worry. We got a couple here to play. Let's go to our first voicemail.
Dear Buster, this is Dan from Utah, and I need some relationship advice. You know, we've never had a hometown team in Utah to root for, fingers crossed for the future. So I've always kind of rooted for my favorite players and their teams. And my favorite players are Juan Soto and Shohei Ohtani. So last year I was squarely on the Padres bandwagon and the Angels hope train, and it didn't go so well. But this year, they chose new teams. The problem is they joined the evil empire teams that I could never, ever root for. So my question is, do I go find a new man crush, find some new favorite players, or do I deny my lifelong morals and embrace the dark side and root for a Yankees-Dodgers World Series? Please help. Signed, Perplexed in Utah.
I would say a fun team to root for would be the Texas Rangers. Okay. Mm-hmm. Not only are they the defending champions, but that is a team with a great culture. They have a great manager. No service time manipulation, Taylor. They got Wyatt Langford making his debut on opening day, looking great. Players are all in. As I said on the Clown Car edition today, I really think that this is a team that's going to be a tough out in the postseason if they get these starting pitchers healthy. Max Scherzer, Jacob deGrom, Tyler Mahle. That this could be a much better team by the end of the year.
Hey, guys. This is Landon from Atlanta. Buster, phenomenal job on the ESPN broadcast of the podcast. That was awesome. But after watching that and seeing Hembo's bold prediction of Bo Bichette being traded to the Dodgers, this made me think, how much do you think the Blue Jays are regretting letting Alex Anthopoulos go in favor of Mark Shapiro? I would love to hear your thoughts on this. Thank you.
First off, it was Alex's choice to leave, actually. They offered him a job to stay after the Blue Jays had made the playoffs that year. So he could have had the opportunity to stay, but he decided to go. And look, Mark Shapiro, very well respected in the industry after Cleveland. Now, I would say, I'm in the process of taking votes from executives around baseball, asking him, one of the questions I'm asking them is, who's the best head of baseball operations in the sport? And I'm getting a lot of votes for Alex Anthopoulos.
All right, let's go to the tweets here. You can still tweet us, hashtag Bleacher Tweets. Let's go. I just want to note, Zach Beeson, big Angels guy. He just tweeted hashtag Bleacher Tweets with a big eliminated graphic for the Angels. That's kind of harsh.
Oh, my gosh.
He's gone
a little early.
Yeah, for sure. We got a pair of questions, observations on Otani. People are kind of turning on him in the Bleacher Tweets. The Stone King, he's saying hiding behind his interpreter, including the new one, is weak. Reading prepared written statements is weak. Not taking questions is weak. Shohei is weak and most likely guilty. All right, Stone King. But Bill Walton, Dr. Oyster, he bumped a Bleacher Tweet from December. He writes in, what am I missing? Where's Shohei's personality? Reports are that his teammates like him but require special treatment. As a fan, I just don't get any sense of his personality, maybe other than controlling and guarded. Bringing this back to the top because it's timely, not suggesting guilt or not, just asking anyone has a sense of his personality who guards everything so closely. We talked about this a lot. What any other thoughts on this side?
Yeah, we talked a lot about it last year, how he was very he was entitled with the Angels, and they gave him a lot of autonomy, and that's part of the reason why I wanted Tim Kuhn on today was because I thought his story was so brilliant. Taylor, have you had a chance to read that yet?
Yeah. And I think it really
was a brilliant story.
And it's
about Otani and sort of, the way he's treated in clubhouses. And I thought Tim was really good on the show today describing all that.
He was excellent. And it's something that really the gambling thing has kind of brought this to light, but we've kind of known about it. And I feel like there's with the Shohei hype, I should say, it's kind of been pushed to the edges. We've talked about it a lot, but Tim really, I mean, he's an excellent writer. So he articulated the whole thing perfectly and really dug into it, which I enjoyed. And he was awesome on the show.
Yep. He was great.
Sarah Gillespie at Atypical Faith. She writes in, okay, Bleacher Tweets, opening day falls during Holy Week this year. What is the most sacred part of baseball for you? Giving you the temporary pulpit.
The most sacred part of baseball. Taylor, what would you say?
I really like, I was thinking about it. I like when your team is bad and you go to the game with your family or your friends and you're there just to relax. You can kind of spread out. And that's like where your fandom is like really formed. And I feel like those moments, like that's what you like when your team gets good and things are going well, like that's what you reflect on. You know, those are the times that make it all very special. So I would say that.
I'm going to be a little bit more specific than you. Mm-hmm. I think that it would have been sacred if every year opening day, the first two games played every season, and set aside, I know there was criticism of Major League Baseball for having those two games in Korea, which I think is silly. Like it's an opportunity to market the sport, to have to build on, the enthusiasm around the Dodgers. So I understand why they did that. But in terms of games starting over here, the American League game should be in Baltimore and the National League game should be in Cincinnati. And that should not be messed with.
All right. I'm in, Buster. I'm in.
Okay.
All right. That does it for Bleacher Tweets. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. Again, the number 406-404-8460. It's in the show notes. Feel free to give us a call. We've been getting great voicemails. Had two good ones today. Thanks for writing in, everyone.
Outstanding. And Taylor, thank you. And you're going to have to remind me of all the people that we had on the show today. First off, Tim Kuhn, Jorge Castillo, Sarah Langs, David Cohn, Carl Ravitch, Eduardo Perez. Did I cover it?
You nailed him, Buster.
Okay, very nice. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.